And you've tuned in to NPR WNJT Trent, New Jersey. And the next show on today is a Stream of Random podcast with your host, Hacker Mike. That's right, it's me, the long-awaited. I bet you've all been wondering where I've been, what took me so long, 12 days to edit a podcast of 30 minutes. Well, can you believe it was an hour and a half before I got out the knife? This new road is being used as a speeding ramp for certain people to drive as fast as possible through. It's unbelievable how fast this has turned into a runway. New Jersey has an infestation of the spotted lantern fly, which is an invasive species from Asia. It came around the time of the COVID, and it's super fast. It's like a moth, but it's also like a grasshopper. It can jump really fast. And you'll see them on certain trees sucking out all the sap. And they're taking over here. So I can't even tell you what all I have been doing since. I just put out an episode 417 that I have been working on for so long. It took me forever to edit that. And not only did it take me forever to edit it, but I was ashamed to listen to it, to go back and analyze my ideas. But I have this idea, an intuition, and we've talked about this on the show, that the Turing machine, if you know the inputs, generically, yes, it is undecidable. But if you know the inputs, then it is decidable whether or not it terminates. And a machine that's always being fed the same exact machine in my eyes, it will never terminate, because every time it runs, it'll go into an input loop, reading in the next machine, and it'll always be stuck there. So that's my intuition. Now my logic, my idea would be that there's always going to be a machine that's in it's either in the state of reading in the next machine or executing the next machine, which will never terminate, because the next machine will then, once it's read in and start running, it will read in the next machine and basically make copies of itself and never terminate. Now this machine could be modified so it only can read itself, and if it reads anything else, it will fail. And then that could also be modified that it doesn't have to read an extra copy of itself in, because it always knows that the copy is going to be the same as itself. So if you could just compare the input to itself, store a copy of its initial state, compare that as well, we get to a new level. And I guess I'd have to draw this out, where the Turing machine is modified to not blindly spawn a new machine or make copies of the new machine, but just to use itself. And the next time it's run, I guess we'll need some type of tape to know where each machine is in its state of execution. But the tape would just eventually be written with one state per machine. New mushroom, hold on. So maybe we can compress the second machine down so we just have one state. We know it's going to be reading in a new machine. And when executing it only can do that. After it reads it in, it can start executing that machine. And we know that state. And the executing of the machine will go immediately to the reading in of the new machine, and then the executing. So it's only going to go between reading and executing and comparing. So I'm wondering if we actually... So basically it would be an endless loop that's constantly reading in the new machine and executing it, and reading in a new machine and executing it. That's all it would do. Okay. And this may be a trivial finding, and maybe other people have found it too, but it's just something I've been thinking about. I've been going over this whole language theory again. Yesterday we put together some puzzle. It was the world map, and the world map is an exceptionally easy puzzle to put together if you know the world map. It has lots of clues on it, like the degrees on the bottom in west, north, and south on the sides, lots of names of countries, so that's all pretty good. So solving a puzzle, if you know the input, you know the output, it's much easier. That's the point here. That's the message. So the language of the input system also becomes reduced, and we can reduce the recursion, the cardinality of the recursion. I'm just thinking about that fox that I found, that dead fox, how unusual it was to find something like that. Well, there's a groundhog running, and how the dead fox is probably a displaced animal. So, if we know the input, if we can reduce the strength of the input language by knowing it ahead of time, we can reduce the complexity of the Turing machine problem. If we can go from a fully open language where everything is possible to one that is very constrained, optimizations will be possible. So reduction in strength. And by feeding a machine back onto itself, we definitely can do that. Now, we could also say we want to feed all the variants of a machine to itself. So that includes different versions over time. That will become much more different. Maybe we can make a machine that learns to remember different states that it had or has been through, to record them, to scan through them. It's like, well, if it's not this machine, then it could be this machine, and it could order them in probability and scan through them. But it's basically increasing the strength of the language again. This is the question of different versions of the compiler, etc. Now, if I apply this idea back to the GNU compiler, a tree structure that can only represent itself and no other program is going to be simpler. It's only going to need structs and fields and types, maybe arrays and lists, but it's going to need a handful of types to bootstrap itself. And I guess this is the bootstrap phase. I've been hunting mushrooms this morning after the rain. The fungal bodies need water to bloom. I'm actually walking through the cemetery right now by the grave of Fat Ding Ng. Now that guy was born in 1937. His parents didn't know what they did to him when they called him Fat Ding. But once he got to America, I'm sure that Fat Ding had lots of issues. But there don't seem to be very many mushrooms at the cemetery. I guess they don't all use green coffins. They say it's better to be judged by 9 than carried by 6. Okay, the sun is coming up and it's getting damn hot already. It's 7:12, so we have another hour and a half of this blathering. So once I got to Rice's theory, and I've been studying Turing and the incompleteness proofs, this is if you allow regular languages. So the complexity of a machine is related to the complexity of the language. If the language is complex, then the machine is necessarily complex. And there's the Chomsky hierarchy of languages, which basically corresponds the hierarchy of machines, starting with deterministic finite automata, regular expressions, or clean, K-L-E-N-E, where if we can reduce the strength of a language down to something that can be recognized with a regular expression, then we can create an automaton to match it very quickly. And that's basically the science of insecurity. That's basically the answer there. Now, if we know enough statistics about the input and we control enough of where it will execute, then we can also reduce the strength of the language. So my ideas of creating the closed world, like just enough to execute an editor, to compile and edit the source code, and even just the edits that have been made so far, meaning you're not actually editing the source code, you're just selecting between versions that we've seen. Those were all strength reductions. Look at that. Voorhees. The fact that they have an oak tree in the... The fact that these people are buried under an oak tree should mean something. So, the reduced language that's needed. Here, Ewing Trepto, Thomas R. Ewing, Mary L. Ewing. So they were saying they could have been orphans. Scammell. So these are names. What's your name, son? Scammel. Okay, I'm getting onto the main street here. Boy, I've missed my walks. I'd like to think that my walking has strengthened me and that I haven't really lost anything for the days that I missed walks. But I have missed a few days. I've been in pain every day. My jaw has been covering from the surgery, redirecting energy towards it, away from other things. And I've just been sleeping and resting as I can. But boy, I feel great walking again. I feel like I'm full of energy. It's so loud here. 60 decibels. I'm just going to go on pause. Okay. Hopefully I got rid of these cars. Look at that lady run. She's so fast. It's just someone running like crazy. You won't see me running like that. We know that an abstract syntax tree will generally be a tree or a graph with different loops in it, but it'll always be of a finite size. And we also know that a part of the tree will describe the rest of the tree, either in a compiled or non-compiled state. We know that we have labels and values, and the values can be integers or floats, whatever constants that are allowed in the language. Literals, they can be references, labels of functions, or basically any other label in or identifier in the system. Variables, so any other node in the system that's already been looked up. So the whole identifier, the identifiers can be replaced with or resolved to other nodes. So basically edges between nodes and different lookups. So you have an arrays as well, and lists, and dictionaries, and so forth. JSON data, YAML. So that's our basic data structure. And then we have the question of what fields occur with what other fields regularly. What groupings are there in the nodes? So you've got nodes with attributes. And this is getting into this generic graph language, like Network X or Dotty GraphViz. And then the question of correspondences, like can you transform from one graph language to another? So a given program, a given compiler will produce a graph of this type version of it. And the graph of this type will be processed by code of this type, so that's the rest of the compiler. So the one part of the program defines the structures, the other part manipulates those structures. Now if we feed a known input into these structures, a known input being specific version of Linux or a specific program, a benchmark. And we have two different implementations of the same compiler or different compilers of the same language. We could create a correspondence between the input and the internal state, and we could relate them to each other. Now, Russian olives. Boy, those things are fast. These goddamn lantern flies. You can't step on them. So now we've gotten some ideas here, and definitely comparing different versions of a program against each other gets complicated. But I covered all of this in my thoughts previously. I didn't tie it into the theory of languages in terms of discrete systems. I should have. I didn't make that connection, that deeper understanding. But we're making those connections now. And I guess a lot of this comes down to how people do programming. It's like it works. The program works under these conditions, but if those conditions change, if the environment changes, then the program breaks down in the environment. And it's not always clear how that environment is set up. It's just implicit. It's not well defined. It just happened. So the environment is really an input in terms of constants, things that should be variables that are constants, right? Misjudging of the strength of something that's stronger than you think it should be. In terms of its variability, its essential Vladimir style invariance, statistical variance or invariance. So we're going to have to study that some more. So every value in the program can be assigned a probability of its occurring. Every bit in a type, the probability of this bit being set in this type. That's what we want to know. Like, oh, you've got a bit flag, you've got 8 bits, you've got an integer. Well, what's the chance of that being ever set? Like, you allocated a long integer using 3 value. Does that make sense? Well, we might need it in the future. So my compiler should be able to help you with that. So let's just define that I want to take as input the GCC and the LLVM source code, and then be able to extract a compiler from that, a new compiler, Persian history as much as I need, coupled with other information about runtimes and virtual machines and operating systems. Because in the end, we don't just want a compiler. We want something that will actually run code. And maybe we don't want a generic operating system that can do anything. Maybe we want a limited operating system that can only do a couple of things. Limited strength. And can we solve for that? So that's my entire thought experiment here. And we've been iterating over this for some time, but I think I'm finally putting this together, the puzzle piece. And another intuition that I had is that my mind is like a fungus. And these years and years of thinking about things have been like underground, like the mycelium growing in the dark. And now I'm finally connecting with other things, like a mycelium connects to a tree and exchanges with them on a certain interface. It's like, you've got some phosphorus for me, because I need that for my bones. The phosphorus in our bones come from the fungus. And where does the fungus get it from? The phosphorus in other people's bones. Does that make sense? Or rocks. But I'm just going to go ahead and say that the phosphorus in our bones could be from the phosphorus in other people's bones. You know, there's only so much, there's a certain amount of recycling that's happening. It's a cycle of life. Cycle of life. And we should be thankful for the fungus to even make that happen. And that's one of the most important lessons. That's one of the most important lessons we can learn. That we are like the temporary fruiting bodies of the fungus connected to a larger mycelium. Like, we pop up, we die, but there's something underneath, a life eternal, that pass on like cells of the fungus growing underground. I've been listening to Paul Stamets a lot. Giuliano Ferrucci, Dennis McKenna. Well, I'm thinking about the richness of this town or township, how much money is here. It's just mind-boggling. Just walking through this corporate data center, looking, it's got airports, train stations, so much commerce, so much money, so many resources here, yet such poverty and crime. Sometimes you have to do something to protect your honor or to show people who you are. And this gets into the question of Turing machines and what do they call them? Universal blockchain computers. It's so good that I have this editing capability now. And my new method is that I mark different sections with labels in Audacity, and then I can export that label file out. Labeling of audio, then coupled with my show notes. I actually have to merge them together so that my labels become my show notes, and I haven't figured out a way to do that just yet using org mode. But I'm thinking Audacity would just be enhanced so that the label could become some kind of Emacs org mode markdown editor. And I think Audacity needs a fork in it. And how come it doesn't run on the mobile? How come there's no native Android Audacity? So getting back to this blockchain, a smart contract on the blockchain, something that could interpret the value block and execute it, something that could accept listener statistics and store it, something that could hold audio and edit it, audio clips, construct a show out of a series of clips that are labeled, a stream, a live stream. See, this is where we get into questions of strength. What does it mean to be a blockchain? What does it mean to be a smart contract? What does that even mean? Well, the idea would be that it's a trusted thing that executes in a way that can't be manipulated. It would have some kind of verification. So my vision is that I can run some program. Like, how would it work? What value do we add? Well, the value would be having player. See, this is where we get into different apps, different technologies. Why is this so hard for me to perform it? Let's say we can decompose. Where I kind of get is the introspector is the fungus now. If we can attach our mycelium to all these different programs and decompose them to their components, reuse those to create new life. That's the message here. Recycling of resources. Like, Audacity is inserting code to track users. Like, they've broken the trust. People don't want to deal with them. So then the question becomes, can we take it and decompose it into something better? So What are the pieces of code that we can extract from it? What is it that we use it for? So if we can collect the usage information from it for, say, podcasting, not necessarily the audio files, but like what functions are used, how it's used, people could opt in to that, and we pay them for that, and they choose to anonymize it or not. This is more than just podcasting. A podcast is just a stream of voice, but we also want a stream of usage. A stream of usage. So, and this usage stream or behavioral tracking is what Audacity wants to do. Everyone wants to track behavior. Like, what pages are you visiting? What websites are you visiting? And Brave started with that.
The Brave browser pays you to watch advertising.
And I got to record some of these ideas, so it's just that simple.
So if we can reduce the strength or complexity of a general purpose Turing machine,
you know how it's going to be used. You can constrain its usage. It might make an interesting case for computation, distributed computation. And then transactions and payment.
Let's say if people produce something of value, like a podcast, that people want to listen to, and the clips are actively listened to and shared and make their way around the internet. So if the information or clip is valuable, then people would opt in to stream private listening data or watch advertising or do something that would monetize the listening or give money directly. I mean, there's many different ways to do it, but selling your private data is definitely valuable. It's something that you could actually give to the podcast producer or his cohort. The value in question here could be as simple as, here's a little bit of money, I listened to your whole show. Or it could be a variable value for a given timestamp, a boostagram. You could also say that one particular part was of particular value to you.
And this gets into this question, I'm just going to switch subjects here. I do switch subjects. I noticed that while editing, oh my god. Just complete random switches in subjects. They're talking about the hubris of humans to think that they're the smartest things on the planet, to think that we're in control of the environment, that we're responsible for it, that we can change global warming, that we can influence everything. So there's a certain, I guess, overestimation of our powers that we have. We had a climate scientist from England move into our house next door in Kansas at the University of Kansas. And I was just thinking how against the idea of openness he was, and I couldn't figure it out until now. Now this whole climate science is very political and based upon this idea that we have to do something, that we can do something. How much we think we can do and how much of it is not proven, it's conjecture and political will. And this is the same thing with a lot of these policy decisions driven by science. Who controls the science, and how honest and open is it? Does the science not serve the master of politics? So this is kind of where we're getting to. All right, so what else we got? Did I tell you the bill for the baby was $80,000? I think I mentioned that. That's a lot of money, kids. So I'm busy rotating keys at work, and I realize the value in that, not only secure the system, but also to get control of it, understand who's doing what. Usage statistics. So now we're going to kind of focus back on saying, well, usage of something, you know, listening to a podcast at this time point, okay, reading some notes in this position in the file. So if the usage data is so important and so valuable, then people should be willing to pay for it. So to collect it, you have to provide a service that's easy to use. That's why YouTube is so powerful, because it's so easy to use that you're willing to give them your usage data. Now, I've been thinking about voice recognition. If I repeat myself, I can visually see the same pattern occurring over and over, the same visual pattern in just terms of amplitude, not even frequency. And I've been studying these car noises. I suppose that burning a body also releases its nutrients. Maybe some of it is the air into smoke, and those would be lost. But maybe that stuff in the air can be absorbed by plants as well. Or does it come down again and settle on the ground? And fungus appears the first things after a forest fire. walking down the street, really hot. The sun's beating right down my head. It's already so late in the day. We're closer to the sun. Supposedly some girl died of heat exhaustion playing basketball. So I've been experimenting with these pallet fences, and I'm thinking that with two legs, I can hold the pallet up the fence. And I could use four rebars, two legs, and have it kind of lean against the fence, the existing fence. So if reducing the complexity or getting use of statistics is the key to, I guess it's the key to exploitation. If you know something's going to happen regularly, then you can exploit that possibility. You can preempt something. So that at one company I worked for, I did something different than was expected, and it blew up in my face because the people were so trained to act in a certain way, they didn't expect anything to be different. They only treated everything the same way. It's like throwing a monkey wrench in the system. It gummed up the cogs. So our old house is selling for $260,000. Someone, I don't know who, sent me a t-shirt with a fungus on it. Mycelium, your psyllium, we all are psyllium. Eventually, it says, has a picture of a mushroom. And they sent it to my old address. I don't know if it's one of our listeners. So whoever sent that to me, thank you. I went to the old house, and it was it's empty. They're selling it for $260,000. Crazy market right now. I gotta see what Peter Schiff has to say. That was an extraordinarily bad idea I just did, just walking that one street in the hot sun, sweating my ass off. So I think I'm gonna move my walks back to nighttime. But I do enjoy these morning walks. I just have to get up earlier. I need to get out at 4 in the morning. I was sleeping. I got up last night at 1 and finished up editing that show and put it out at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock this morning. Oh my God. So, well, what else? Are we finished with this yet? We're not really finished. So it's the attention economy. People have limited attention, and we want to pay. People are paying to get your attention, to show you ads. It's pretty simple. And you don't mind some ads if they sell you something that you actually want, which has always been my opinion. Like if I could tell the system what I want, like actually what I want and what I'm looking for, then I'd be willing to watch ads because I'm looking for those things. And each segment of a show is talking about something. And the talk is the output of some function in some language. There's these companies that come to your door and they're like, oh, we're working in the neighborhood. We want to sell you a roofing, free estimate. And I got about 1 million phone calls from them, and all they want is a copy of my insurance policy. Eventually, I told them to go to hell. Do not call me anymore. So I'm kind of thinking about farming in general. I know someone who's working on an indoor farm, some factory. They have tax credits for farmland, but they should have tax credits for not developing the land at all. It seems to me, just to keep it, it should be worth more terms of taxes to buy a piece of property and not develop it than it should be developed from a system of society that you could get paid based upon your biodiversity. I guess that's the idea of carbon credits in some way. So let's focus back on this usage. So the usage of a system can be represented as a language string of tokens as inputs to a machine. So these are just a given system is a language, and its usage are strings that are fed to that system, and they're accepted by that system, okay? And then the output of that system is something else. It gives some value to the user. Now, this chest actually looks like something of value. It's a toy chest. So we have some form of identity of who the user is to varying degree of information. Let's just say that they can be represented as a signature, as a cryptographic identity, and then the usage data resolved as a series of symbols that are language dependent to the application. So rewinds, plays, how often did someone stop? Did they share it at a certain point? Or click on a link? This is like information that would be relevant to understand. If you have a multimedial application, this would be relevant. And this aggregate information could be used to pay. This aggregate information could be used to pay the producers and distributors and so forth, the entire value chain, in a unique way. So my proposal then would be to get people on board, we offer them a service. So usage information, so people would sign up for free, and we would assign them an ID, make it super easy, and they could start sending usage information, and depending on how much information they want to provide, we would pay them more for it, and then we would sell that usage information according to rules established, and then reimburse them, and then we would pay the people of the system that they used, so they would get a cut. Now, how do you prevent spam? How do you establish a true identity of who that person is? Well, we pay for that as well. So the more of an identity that you can establish, the more trust we have in you, the more vouching that you have, the more weight that you get in this system. And it's not just listening to podcasts, it's also using programs, how you use the program, usage data in general. We'll pay you, I guess we'll pay you, get ads, targeted ads in an application, and collect usage data, and then give some of that money to the developers to fund the development. I think that's the basic idea here, and each part of a program has a different thing. Like, oh, you want to do noise reduction? Well, here's an ad for noise reduction, or here's the most relevant help information based upon your usage. Like, how are you using this? You editing a podcast? Like, here's what you need to know. Blender, all these different apps could be usage enhanced. I guess it's Introspector. I guess we're getting back to the Introspector. So let's just call it a usage enhanced Turing machine, or an annotated Turing machine. A usage annotated Turing machine. Well, this is all stuff to think about. I think it's pretty good. Pretty good. We're tying it all together now. Tying it all together with mycelium. The Introspector reaching out and touching everything. Going all the way back to my original idea. Reduction in force. Reduction in complexity. Through usage and statistical learning. Usage information. Annotation markup. Reproducible use cases. I saw some really cool black morals or something, these balls growing in the woods, hundreds of them in the swamp after the rain. I need to figure out what type of mushroom that is. I saw another mushroom in the, I think I saw three different types of mushrooms today in my walk. So, definition of technical debt, the true cost of communication is high. The true cost of understanding something is high, and putting things off to later creates debt. Twin engine airplane with little tips on its wings. I'm done. I really am. We're going to do some more research. I'm going to edit this show, and I will put extensive links, and we're going to continue to improve our process of editing and annotating and publishing. I'm still going to put some more movies out onto BitChute and those other platforms that got lots of views, spreading the spores of the fungus. So maybe that's the conclusion that I'm coming to, that I'm part of the fungus. I'm part of the system, part of something bigger. We all want to be part of something bigger. Well, I guess we're all a part of something bigger, aren't we? The unending chain of life. Got two boys. We're also part of that now. I'm gonna go see if I have it, can get some more elderberries off that tree. I know this has been a noisy episode, lots of cars, but I was on a roll, so I'll try and do my best. But I think we've gotten beyond, just podcasting now, because we're recording. We're displaying clips, and I'm thinking a website that can play in the browser that would play the podcast, display the clips, display the links, track the user if they want to, send feedback to producer if they want it, the user wants it, in an anonymized or personalized form. And I think that the selling of your personalized information, like we could just do sessions to begin with, that aren't related to a person or an identity. Like, you can create as many identities as you want. You can create one every time you start the program. It should be cheap and easy to create an identity. And then selling that identity should be a process of registering and vouching and saying that this is actually useful. And the more vouches that you get, the more valuable that identity is that you're trying to sell. That contain usage information. It could all be spam. It could all be waste. So I think we'll have a marketplace for people to bid on it. And once you've established your identity and someone has bought that information, then they could then resell it, but they don't have to give it away. So the basic idea is that people would pay. Look at these, some hookahs. I'm gonna grab some of these. Oh wow, today is Friday the 13th. So happy Friday the 13th, guys. I just got a big bunch of sambuca, or elderberries, enough to make me a nice little drink this morning. I'm working on processing them. Turns out that the sprouting of the seeds is quite involved. I'm basically gonna just spread them out in some planting area and leave them over the summer and the winter. And they say that they might not even pollinate with themselves, so that you might get a completely different plant or a hybrid. I gotta get to work. I've got 6 more minutes. Okay, guys. See ya.
Feed the fungus.